Okay.
Welcome everyone and ask for approval of the minutes, which I think are under tab one.
Yes, sir.
Any comments?
Move to approve.
Second?
Second.
Opposed? All right, approved. We will then look at resolution, I believe, to appoint corporate officers. And Jeff, I think there's a groundswell movement, probably unbeknownst to you, by the way, so you shouldn't have come to this meeting, but I believe you're about to be chairman. Do we need a motion on this?
Yes, and then could the motion also include that you remain as vice chairman?
That is a surprise.
I second that one.
Yeah, I'll second that.
Okay. So is there a motion?
So move.
Second?
Second.
Any opposed? All right, passed. Jeff?
Thank you.
Hand it over to you.
Okay, well, thank you. Just very quickly, it's a real honor, obviously, and a privilege to chair such an organization that I think exudes such excellence. And it really is a gem, I think, the state of Texas, the UT system, the A&M system. And I just couldn't be prouder to be a part of this. The quality of an organization is about 90% in part to the quality of the executive staff, I believe, and not the board. And so, Bruce, I'm going to lean heavily on you and your executive staff to continue the excellence that you guys have demonstrated over the last many, many years. So thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. Yes, sir. The
what do we have?
We have the resolution of appreciation, two of them.
Okay. Do you have those?
Jeff, if I could.
Yes. Yep. We have those.
The motion you called for was to elect Jeff as chairman, you as vice chairman, and all of the other people.
Yes.
In the resolution.
Sorry, I was not clear on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So we have two resolutions. Two certificates of appreciation, both Morris Foster and Bobby Stillwell. I'll just read for a moment. In recognition of the background and expertise, Morris Foster was appointed by Governor Perry to the A&M system in 07 and served as chairman from 09 to 011 and was reappointed in 013 for another six-year term. I would just like to provide my personal appreciation to Morris. He did a wonderful job, I think, as chair, and we will miss him. So can we have an applause for him? I think. And then our second resolution is to Bobby Stillwell, a good friend of mine and a former Board of Regents at University of Texas System. In recognition of his substantial background and expertise in law and business, Robert Stillwell was appointed by Governor Rick Perry to the Board of Regents of the UT system in 2009, was appointed to the Board of Regents to the Board of Directors of the University of Texas Investment Management Company in 2013. Bobby's considerable legal expertise, I think his pragmatic thinking, he has been incredibly helpful to the University of Texas Board, I know, and was provided a lot of insight and value. So if we could, a show of appreciation for him. So do I have a motion to approve these two resolutions of appreciation?
You do.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. With honor, we conclude that. All right. So, in terms of committee assignments, we have a resolution, and the resolution reads as follows. Directors of the corporation are hereby designated as the Audit and Ethics Committee of the Board of Directors. That would be John White, Phil Adams, and H. Lee S. Hobson. Subject to the approval by the Board of Regents at the University of Texas at a future meeting. And as well, John D. White is hereby designated the chair. Thank you very much, John.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Be it resolved, the directors of corporations are hereby designated as the Compensation Committee of the Board of Directors. Lee Hobson, Kyle Bass, Steve Hicks, and Ard Moore. Lee Hobson is hereby designated as the chair of the Compensation Committee. Thank you, Lee, and thank you all for participating in the Compensation Committee. And then finally, the Risk Committee will be composed of Kyle Bass, Lee Hobson, Ard Moore, John White, with Kyle Bass being designated as the chair of the Risk Committee. And then finally, our final committee, Policy Committee, Steve Hicks, Phil Adam, and John White, with Steve Hicks hereby being designated as the chair of the Policy Committee. Do I have a motion to approve those committee assignments?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right, motion passes. Thank you all very much for your participation.
The only thing I'd add is we anticipate that the UT System Regents will be appointing another regent to our board, and when that happens, that individual will
include appropriately
eagerly assume committee chair membership.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Bruce. With Bruce, would you take us through the funds update?
Sure. On page 2, behind tab 3, page 15 in Diligent, is our dashboard where we tried to create a one-page summary of the 10 risks we outlined early this fall. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this page because we're going to spend time in each of the 10 areas. That really is the agenda for this meeting. What I'd note is mostly greens, red in scenarios, but I think that'll always be the case because we tend to focus on downside scenarios. On the next page is the pie chart showing that as of the end of February, we were at $35.7 billion of assets under management, half of that in the Permanent University Fund, $7.2 billion in the Long-Term Fund, which, as a reminder, is the summation of roughly 10,000 individual endowments, and then still holding at $1.1 billion for the Permanent Health Fund. Despite distributions over a decade, endowment returns have offset those distributions and added to the corpus to keep it real in inflation-adjusted terms. We've hit $7 billion in the Intermediate Term Fund, and we've got $1.9 billion in the short-term or working capital fund for the UT system. The first risk and the main risk that causes all other risks is underperformance risk. Our objective is to offset distributions plus inflation. And so the first risk we look at is, well, what if we don't meet that objective? So on page 5, 18 in Diligent, these are our returns. This is for the fiscal year to date, 6 months ending February. You can see the 1.06% for the PUF, the 1.47% for the JEF, 29 basis points for the intermediate term fund. We were positive in March, so the 7 month returns, you don't have this in your paper, but we're 1.35% for the PUF, 1.91% for the general endowment fund, although the intermediate term fund, because it's very, it's got 30% in long-only investment-grade fixed income, was down in the month of March, but it's still positive 5 basis points. So this is where we kind of shaded it half green, half yellow, because we're not on track to hit the 7.5%. If you assume a 5% distribution and a 2.5% inflation, although I believe that the current distribution rate is 5.5%. Now, inflation's not running 2.5, it's running sub 2, so we still kind of long-term try to target in on that 7.5%, and obviously for the first 6 months we're not at 3.75%. The next page shows the returns by the various investment styles and asset classes. And again, it's just a visual to try to kind of highlight what's been working for the first 6 months of the fiscal year, what hasn't. Again, we're going to go into detail when we do the sub-portfolio reviews, but suffice it to say that the commodity complex, natural resources complex, emerging market equities, the credit part of the hedge fund portfolio and the long bonds have been negative, were negative in absolute returns for the first 6 months. The next page shows UTIMCO, which is in the blue, relative to other generic investment strategies, beginning when in 1996 when UTIMCO was created. So again, the baseline down at the bottom, T-bills, $100 would be worth $156 now, basically have grown with inflation. A bond portfolio, the Barclays U.S. Ag, would have done better. A 60-40 portfolio is the red line, would have done substantially better. Our more diversified balanced portfolio has outperformed the 60-40 over this long period of time. It is the case, beginning with about a year ago, that a stock-only portfolio, the green line, has outperformed our diversified portfolio. We've seen that before. We saw that in the tech bubble, if you will, back in 2000. In the 2007 period, the green line got close to the blue line. So, you know, we've experienced this before, but we continue to believe that over the long term, even though we do have an equity bias, it's a global equity bias, and it's not it'll outperform. The final chart on returns just says how we've done relative to what we advertised we'd do. The advertisement's the red line. The green line is what we've done, so we're slightly, just a little bit better. The orange line's the policy portfolio, so generally what we advertise is the policy portfolio, so it's actually lagged. Beginning with the recession in 08, it's come back some, but because of the value add, because we've outperformed our policy portfolio, we've been able to meet our targets. So with that, the second risk is market risk, because to the extent that we can't just invest in T-bills and offset distributions plus inflation, we need to take market risk. And Susan Chin, who runs public equities with Amanda Hopper and also chairs our Portfolio Positioning Task Force, can talk a little bit about markets, please.
Sure. If you turn to page 10 or page 23 in Diligent, the chart on the right shows just the dispersion in performance of markets in the past 6 months. So in local terms, China and India markets were up 50% and 8% respectively. On the negative side, Russian and Brazil markets were down 25% and 54% respectively, and broader emerging markets were down about 8%. Other big negative performing markets were UBS commodity index down 18%, as well as oil down 48%. And then you can see in the middle there in the blue, developed equity markets continued to do well with S&P up 6%. On the left, you can see the sensitivity or beta of the endowments to these markets. So our beta to all equities continues to be about 0.6, with our beta to U.S. equities being a little bit lower at 0.5, which makes sense with your global diversified portfolio. And our beta to interest rates and currencies remains about negative 0.2. The next page shows our up capture and down capture.
Let me jump in just because, you know, Jeff and I were talking a little earlier, and Jeff said, what do you see as one of the biggest challenges for the year? And the first thing I said was low market returns. That, because of the debt, because markets have run up, my view, and I think the conventional wisdom, is that it'll be challenging to get high absolute returns from almost any market out there. I think Bill Gross just said short vol on the German bond, but there's not, and so I think that will be a challenge. And you know, if we kind of see on this chart that Susan just went over, I think Mark Warner said we should go 100% into China. He would have been right because it was up 50%. But other than that, it's challenging to find great markets to just kind of ride.
Page 11 or 24 in Diligent shows the up and down capture of the endowments versus U.S. equity markets, and then also global equity markets. So
the ACWI is the all is the all country world
index, right, which includes a mix of developed and emerging markets. So 62% of the upside of U.S. markets, 30% of the upside, and 67% of the upside of global markets, and 41% of the downside. So that positive skew continues to be.
Bruce, what's your historical kind of up and down capture?
Yeah, we used to be a little high. We just started looking at the all world. We used to just measure U.S. We used to be a little higher in the up capture in the U.S. and a little lower in the down capture, although Uzi had done some more detailed analysis. And what we found is that in the tails, we don't capture as much of the up-ups, and we don't provide as much protection in the down-downs. We do fine in the ups and fine in the downs, but the really extremes, you know, we don't fare as well. And arguably, we've had, you know, some pretty dramatic extremes, the big down in the recession, the big up in the U.S. market. So it wasn't substantially higher but in the up capture and wasn't substantially lower in the down capture, I think. The 62 used to be 64, 65. The down capture of 36 used to be 33. But we have seen some deterioration in those numbers, and because of the extremes.
Okay,
thank you. Given the exposure to markets, the third risk is various scenarios, because while we may have long-term views. We have views over what markets will do in the long term. You know, we're going to go through different cycles and different scenarios. And one of the things we do is not only look historically at what's happened in various extreme scenarios, but what might happen in certain scenarios we'll hypothesize. And so Uzi leads our effort on that. By the way, I used to do this as a monologue, and Steve Hicks thought he really enjoyed that, but I thought that y'all would benefit more from letting the people who do the work actually tell you about it. Sorry, Steve.
As Bruce was saying, kind of a lot of what we do at the endowment is balance all the various risks and balance the short term and the long term. So one of the things we are looking and holistically versus the market risk and other risks is specific scenarios. If you look at page 26 in Diligent, or 13 on the hard copy, these are the forward-looking scenarios. So there are two kinds of scenarios we're looking. One is if a scenario of the past would repeat itself, which we can be very quantitative and exact because we know what happened, but that's kind of very backward-looking. The more interesting, maybe less accurate, but more interesting are the ones, the forward-looking. What could happen? And here it's, as I said, more qualitative. The first one, as the more severe, is what we call a U.S. liquidity squeeze. We see that as some policy error, some communication error, something kind of going wrong with basically with the Fed. The closest example we can think about is the 1937, which kind of victory was declared too early. Again, history doesn't repeat itself exactly, but that's a frame of reference. And on policy, we expect to lose about 22%, and the endowment would be very similar. At this point, our managers continue to be defensive, but we don't have a lot in tactical. We'll discuss that a bit later. And we have very little in terms of hedges. I'll get back to that also.
Uzi, can I just ask? I know we asked on the risk call, but the inputs to that particular situation are what? Where are interest rates moving in that scenario, and then how hard are you testing how hard are you stressing the equities? Like I'm interested in orders of magnitude what's going on in a liquidity squeeze.
So what kind of, it's more qualitative. We're not making a specific assumption on interest rates. For example, we looked at the Fed tantrum we had, now it's 2 years ago, was without any move on the interest rates, equity jumped. And on the other hand, 1937, we had the equity jumps. So it's a scenario kind of we were thinking if things go wrong, and without being specific on interest rates, how far equity could move. And we could see a scenario that equities are moving around 40% on something that basically is either a policy mistake or a communication mistake, because I mean interest rates can rise and everything can be well, or even can be accepted as an indication that all is well.
But what we did, well, you did put a number to, we didn't put a specific number to interest rates. We did go through the asset classes and said equities will drop 40 to 50%. Gold will rally 50%. And so we didn't say interest rates will go from 50 bips to 2.5 bips, but we just said if there's an oops, a big oops, this is what we see. Now, looking backward on the next page, there's the bond market correction in 94. Where we think our current portfolio will only go down about 4%. The S&P went down 8% back in 94. So, you know, that this scenario would be much more dramatic than that.
Yeah. As a frame of reference, what policy equities is 1937, I think that would be the it's more like 40% and not in 94, tech was not yet bubbling, but it was already rising. So there were, while we had the bond, kind of a bond crisis, other asset classes did not crash as much as we think they could.
So let me just to tie a couple of remarks. Our biggest concern, I think, is not one of these dramatic scenarios, although they could certainly happen and we're concerned about it. It's more what I was talking about earlier, you know, as Jeff and I were talking. It's the nothing scenario. There's no growth. It's not like there's a big fall off. It just kind of grinds down. Nothing's really going on.
It's why I asked, right? This 37 scenario is a scenario that let's assume the people running the Fed understand that one pretty well, and we're not going to revisit that. But the scenario that we're trying to show to the client here are the various kind of, you know, let's say doomsday scenarios on the front, and then some shocks on the right. I would suggest that we put in one more column, that is maybe the center of the fairway column of a year out. Maybe we raise rates 150 basis points, and maybe equities sell off when we start raising rates. And in that environment, what does the client expect a year or two out in a more likely scenario than say hyperbolic scenario of a complete disaster of 1937. I think that would be helpful for us as a board to kind of, this is more on your point, Bruce, than nothing to the slightly down market.
And in fact, we're totally aligned with you. We are about to kick off, and Susan and Uzi will lead the effort, the annual investment policy review,
Okay. Which
we'll bring to this a joint risk and policy committee in June, and the UTIMCO board in July, and the Regents in August.
Yeah.
And as part of that review, what we started, you know, we're required to say here's what we think our asset allocation will be, our risk budget will be, and then we advertise a return. And so as part of that, we will advertise a return.
Good.
Expectation. And what we started doing in recent years is we still have kind of our long-term view, because this is a long-term portfolio, but we try to fold in a shorter-term view. Now, for us, a year, two, three is more the shorter-term view. And so we're going to do that. And you may recall that last year what we advertised as return was less than 7.5%. Terry we've dialogued with Terry just recently on that. For less than 7.5% for the endowments, less than inflation plus 3% for the ITF. So again, those are long-term goals, but in the short term, given the concerns you've articulated and we share, you know, we don't know that we're going to hit that number.
Right.
So we will absolutely.
Well,
do
if
that.
You just if you just add one more column here on the right. Of raising interest rates too quickly over the next couple of years. So it's a medium-term view, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of 2 to 4 years out, what happens?
And to be clear, notwithstanding that these are strange times, right? So half the government securities in Europe, I think, are trading with a negative yield. So the starting point's a little different. But number one, it says returns. I take it this is drawdown.
It's returned from the trust.
We probably want to be clear about that.
Yeah.
If you suggest returns, then I probably want to say over what period did you mean.
Right.
So I think we mean drawdown.
Right.
And then the second point is we've run a really good matrix before. I mean, Kyle, it might have actually been before you came on, but I'm sure we've reviewed it in some retreat or something. But where you guys looked at inflation, and everybody thinks rates going up has got to be horrible. That certainly would be the view depending on how rates go up and why, right? A shock or exogenous variable. But we did a matrix where sometimes, historically, whether rates go up or down, what it does to stocks, and sometimes it's counterintuitive. But that doesn't mean that's where we're going. But that could be useful for you guys to pull back out as part of that exercise.
That's helpful. We'll do that. You're right. We kind of did spend a lot of time on that 5 or 6 years ago. Again, we didn't come up with it on our own. Bridgewater has done a lot of the work. And one of the complications is, depending upon your view on inflation and growth, and it's, so it's a two-by-two, you'd come up with very different portfolios.
This was slightly different when you guys start looking at it. It was a matrix, you know, on where rates go and what historically has happened. So similar, but a little bit different than the Bridgewater thing. I think you guys actually pulled together a lot of stuff internally. Sure, other sources too. But.
Okay.
Yeah, the matrix kind of is started maybe from Bridgewater, but on our specific portfolio, if there's higher inflation and lower growth, that's very bad to an equity-oriented portfolio as ours is. So the Bridgewater kind of might have different solutions than being equity-oriented, but the fact is we are equity-oriented, and this would be a weak spot if there's low growth and high inflation.
Hey, Bruce, one last thing very quickly. So, you know, your worst-case scenario, you look at a 22.6% drawdown, let's call it, but then you go to the next page and you know, the Lehman, you know, or 08 time frame, you were down 31. Are you saying is the portfolio constructed that much differently today? That, I mean, if you applied Lehman scenario analysis in to the existing portfolio, what would that look like?
The Lehman scenario to the existing portfolio, that's the 31%. So it's not what actually happened. It's what the Lehman scenario in 08 repeated itself.
I see. Oh, these are projected. This is not what happened. What did happen to our portfolio during Lehman times?
It wasn't that much different. No. I remember correctly.
We were down about, at the peak, 27, 30, I think, was our...
More like 33, but...
Okay, all right. It almost brought that out.
Before I came on the board.
Yeah, before our current board.
That's a good
observation as to why this squeeze isn't as severe as what happened with Lehman.
Yeah. I think that's why thinking about drawdown is different than return. What we've talked about for a lot of years is because it's impossible to put everything on the chart. But what's not in here is, okay, how about an old-fashioned bear market if the government doesn't interfere with it?
Right.
And that could be a 2 or 3 year negative cumulative return. That the client needs to understand this is looking, I think, at shock drawdowns.
And this is really, I think it's important, I mean, that the Board of Regents understands this with kind of eyes wide open.
That's right.
I just want to make sure that our drawdown scenarios are not conservative, are what we actually believe them to be. And you're projecting a 31% down on Lehman. So anyway, just take a look at that to make sure that we are.
Things could be very ugly. I think my main takeaways as we study the scenarios are two things. One is diversification is a good line of defense. Many scenarios are to a specific asset class or a specific country. So old, just plain diversification makes things work in a portfolio like ours, and the long-term investment. A lot of these scenarios are very sharp, are very kind of big drawdowns, but there was a recovery. So if we were looking
at... We ended up down 13% for the fiscal year, September 1 through August 31st. So September 15th...
We need to send Bernanke a thank you letter.
Yes. If you write that. We'll write that for you to sign, Kyle.
Yes. Looking from 2015 back, it's recovered and more. But if since we're long-term investors and we're diversified, really the biggest concern is exactly what Bruce was saying, is just the nothing.
We'll run that.
What Art is saying, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, is give us also a 72 to 74 scenario as to kind of what was going on.
Bear market.
Bear market.
That's a great suggestion.
We've shot all the bear markets. They're extinct.
Yep.
We don't allow that anymore. Yeah. Print money.
Right. So this has been helpful. This is great.
This is kind of another scenario we showed in the past on the same line as 76 to 81, a five-year scenario,
You better not show that one, actually. You take rates to 18, and our portfolio is going to look very different.
Yes. I mean, market, we were doing some, but it was still 10% negative returns over 5 years. About as bad as it can be.
On page 14, where we do these historic scenarios, this is just a subset of all the ones that Uzi and Kate run. By the way, I sent out an email, but let me just say it for the record in the boardroom. Uzi and Kate, our risk management team, has been nominated for Risk Management Team of the Year by Institutional Investor Magazine. So kudos to you.
Congrats.
When I sent out the email, for the record, the chancellor emailed back, "Congratulations, now get back to work." Mm-hmm. I, of course, told him we'd never stopped working. But. All right. So the next risk is just volatility risk. These are extremes. These scenarios are kind of extremes, but then we also we expect just normal ongoing volatility in capital markets.
On volatility, again, volatility is just one of the risks that we look at, and the way we figured the best way to look, since volatility changes a lot by the markets, this can be as low as sometimes it's 10% volatility, it can be high as 14, 15 in extreme downturns. What we look at is how our volatility or expected volatility, and specifically on the downside, how that compares to the volatility of the policy portfolio, because that ratio is basically the actions that we take. Because when the markets kind of move from a 15% volatility to a 25% volatility, we expect both the portfolios to move at the same time. This has been our experience. The ratio is something that we manage. This is the risk management. If we want to be close to policy when we're defensive, this ratio by our actions drop. This is the measure of time that we look at, not the absolute level of volatility. On page 29 of Diligent is where we are, and we have over the past almost 2 years now been running very close to policy, tactical, both in the risk level, the volatility level, and in terms of actual asset allocation. We have not made very big tactical bets, and that shows on this relative volatility chart that we're very close to 100%. The next slide is when you look at volatility attribution. Volatility has this feature of diversification, that some things cancel, so they can be volatile and risky on their own, but within a portfolio they look differently. So this is just looking at the different components of where our manager risk is. And as you see, the bigger ones.
Sure, I'll take both. I'll take both right things.
Value Act, which is a concentrated long-only manager, one of the highest in dollar value that we have, is running the biggest attribution in terms of volatility. Viking, which we have both.
And Value Act's very concentrated portfolio. It's large and it's 10 stocks. And it's long-only public equity.
Viking really being the second, that's over 3%, and that has two mandates, one a long-only and one on a long-short. Overall, we think that the private has the biggest implied volatility. Privates do not show actual volatility month-to-month, but we use proxies to estimate them, public market comparisons. And as you can see here, the private investments is a big and growing portion of the book. It's a big portion of the risk budget. The hedge funds being hedged and the portfolio of hedged components is, again, in the big picture, is a relatively smaller piece of of the volatility attribution. They can be volatile on their own, and hedge funds can go up and down, but they tend, for the most part, to do it differently than long only and privates. Not to say that they never are correlated, but most of the time they're not.
Over how long a period have you developed this chart?
You know, this, you're looking at what, 3 years? This representation.
It's almost artistic. I mean, it's
very colorful.
It's Thank complex, you. I guess. Yes.
Well, you know, I started out as a consultant, and so my colleagues like to tease me that I pine for 2x2s, that if we can. And if both axes are somehow gradated, it just doesn't get any better than that. So. But the real work, you got to come up with the numbers. The graphic is, you know, the easy part. So, so we talked about the first risk of underperformance, not making what the regions take. And then we said, so if we can't just invest in T-bills, we can invest in markets. And so there's market risk and scenario risk and volatility risk, downside volatility risk. But then we make the decision, you, the regents, have made the decision to have an active investment management organization. So the fifth risk is we're taking active management risk. And how's that doing? And so page 32 in Diligent, page 19 in the paper copies, we just look at the what we call the value add, the difference between actual returns and the returns of our policy benchmarks, what would be a passive portfolio. And look, we're having a great year. For the first 6 months, the endowments had added 183 basis points. By the way, for the seventh month, we have that. We're up to 232 basis points. And so the actual returns would be negative without the value add. So we have slightly positive returns because we've been able to generate value add. That value add, $600 million for the first 7 years. In the ITF, it's not on this page, but the value add for 7 months is 209 basis points, or another $145 million. So for the first 7 months, $745 million. I believe UTEMCO's all-time peak was about 09, where we added 400 basis points, something like that, and generated $1 billion of value add. We printed up T-shirts. I printed up T-shirts. I was warned not to, but I did it anyway. It was the UTEMCO Billion Bucks Club. I told staff that if we could hit $1 billion again this year, yes, I'll spring for the T-shirts. But as usual, I get ahead of myself. When we dissect the components of the value add on the next
page, ITF outperformed that much.
Hedge funds. And then you'll see our bond portfolio is up a couple hundred basis points.
Right.
I mean, it's – and that's what
Above the index. Is it?
Yeah. Now, the absolute returns, you know, with year-to-date's only 5 basis points. So the ITF has only returned 5 basis points. I think that's correct for the fiscal year.
What's the allocation of the ITF to hedge funds?
It's 40% in hedge funds, 45 hedge funds, 30 investment grade fixed income, and the remaining 25 is kind of smeared across equities. Smeared being a sophisticated financial term. So when we dissect where the value add's coming from on page 20, paper, page 33, it's really the external manager value add, which is what we look to do primarily as our day jobs. I would note that the insurance hedges, basically the Japanese yen position, has been positive this year for us by 10 basis points. As Uzi mentioned, we're doing very, very little in the way of tactical allocation. And so 170 of the basis points for the first 6 months came through our active managers. Just to put it in perspective, the 117 basis points in the long only or MCC book, that's about 40% of the endowment. So the absolute contribution from that book is 275 basis points. because it's only 40% of the book, that 275 basis points has 117 basis point impact on the book. And you can see hedge funds, for 6 months, that 36 basis points, just the hedge fund book's 115 basis points. So, and then we're positive in the private markets, but I always need to warn that in the short term, the private market number really bounces around. In the next page is in response to a question Arden had raised in the previous meeting, which was, what does the value add look like by manager? I think you know we circulate separately a very detailed spreadsheet that shows each manager's value add, but we wanted to show it as artistically, John, as we could. So let me set up this chart. The five bars on the left are the long-only or MCC asset classes. We don't really have, we have a $20 million in MCC credit-related fixed income, so we didn't even bother with it. And then the LCC or hedge fund bar and the private investment bar. The width of the bars represents the percentage of assets that that portfolio represents. So private investments is about 28% of all assets. LCC is about 30%. Investment-grade fixed income is only about 6%, and real estate is about 2%. So that's the width of the bars. What this page, and then there's a number off to the side of each bar, which is the value add for that asset class in total. So for investment-grade fixed income, you see the number 261. That asset class beat its benchmark by 261 basis points. What this chart shows is each manager's performance relative to the broad asset class benchmark. So again, just picking on investment grade fixed income, we have a global ag as our benchmark, a global aggregate. And so against that benchmark, Colchester shows a negative. By the way, you can see in real estate, Brookfield's got off to a slow start for us. Almost all of the natural resources managers underperformed the broad benchmark, and positive in developed country equity and emerging markets. But the second way we look at it, there's no question too straightforward that doesn't require a more complicated response. So the second answer is on the next page, page 22 in Diligent, page 35. And this is where we look at a manager's performance against that manager's specific benchmark. So again, just taking investment-grade fixed income, Colchester runs a non-U.S. bond portfolio for us because our internal team runs a U.S.-only portfolio for us. So against its own benchmark, Colchester didn't really underperform like it did. And then what you really see is in the natural resources area, most of the managers disappear because the broad natural resources benchmark is heavily tilted towards the big oil companies. And yet the portfolio that Mark Warner and team have constructed has oil services, it's got metals and mining, it's got midstream. And so each of those managers are benchmarked against a more granular, a more specific benchmark.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that when we get into the specific portfolio summaries. But our benchmark market cap relative to our individual portfolio market caps summed up is about five times bigger. It's about a $10 billion average market cap versus about $2 billion average market cap. So it's just a very different portfolio, much higher growth, much higher beta. And so during periods of drawdown in the sector, we capture more of the downs, and in ups, we capture more of the ups, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But that's, as Bruce is observing, it's less about the individual manager performance than it is the way we've got it constructed.
And can you actually go find these more detailed, smaller cap benchmarks somewhere? I mean, how does the layperson go find the oil field services? I just want to make sure that we're being transparent.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And so how do you,
will it be,
are those readily
so
available?
For example, you're familiar with the OSX,
mm-hmm.
right? It's the OSX versus a very big, broad market cap global equity index.
I think the broad is what, the S&P Natural, what's the broad?
It's the MSCI All World Natural Resources Index. So it's got, you know, it's got all the big European integrateds in it. It's got all sorts of things that are not in our portfolio at all.
I see. And by the way, you know, another one, the big difference you'll see between the two charts is our Chinese manager. So on the first chart, the Chinese manager was big positive. Well, you may recall from Susan, the Chinese markets were up 50%, if I remember correctly. Our, on the second page, you see our Chinese manager actually a bit negative because our manager, even though they had very positive returns, didn't keep up with the China and the Chinese specific benchmark. And the Chinese benchmark was what? Again, MSCI, what did you compare it to?
Well, so the A-share market, MSCI China A-share.
The next page shows our tactical allocation. This was as of the end of February. What I'd like to do is pass out a more updated version so you can see where we were as of, what, Friday, April 17th? So why don't we pass that out, and then I'm going to ask Uzi to speak to it.
All right.
Okay, Uzi.
I got one. I got two.
Again, as Chris was saying, we're not doing a lot on tactical, and the numbers here are relatively small. We're very close to policy. Where we started, what you have in your book, for example, the developed country equities, well, we were overweight, 1.6% at the end of February. Part of the thought process was these markets are becoming relatively frothy, and we thought the emerging markets at this point represent a better value opportunity. So we have been reducing the exposure in developed markets. On the updated chart, you can see the drop from the 1.5% to about 0.5%, and we intend to keep reducing. It's not something we do overnight, but definitely it's within the plan of the next few months.
And if I remember correctly, Susan, this overweight in developed country equity, when we parse through the portfolio, it's really kind of a Europe overweight. It's a U.S. and Japan were kind of under it on target.
Actually, U.S. was under. Japan was over.
Japan was over also. But Europe is, yeah.
And part of the overweight is good performance on this portion of the book, so kind of taking some of the profits off the table. On the other hand, we decided to increase the exposure to emerging markets, funded not from emerging markets, but from the other portions of the equity. So. On the new chart, you see an overweight to emerging markets of 1%, which did not exist in February. The other portion is we're kind of now more into the part of the year that especially the Permanent University Fund is making its distribution. The distributions are around $800 million, which are happening at the back part of the year. So two things we have increased our exposure.
I'm sorry, just as a reminder, we, at the request of the system, made no distributions from the Permanent University Fund to the Available University Fund for the first six months. Normally, we'll evenly distribute it every month. And so we've been piling up the investment-grade fixed income account a little bit because we're now about to make a full year's distributions in the 6 months.
Things that are a bit less liquid, we are kind of, it's a month or two timing, so we have been moving, for example, from the hedge funds, redemptions are coming in, and that caused them to go from slightly overweight to slightly underweight, and this is basically cash that is, as of February, we were higher in cash and therefore higher in investment-grade fixed income, cash is part of it, and that's, again, the cash will go down towards the end of the fiscal year. The other big four, two other big portions, natural resources, we have been underweight, started with about 0.8. We want to get back to neutral because we can think that on the ups, we capture more of the ups, but we are not timing the markets exactly. So we have been legging in over the past 3 months and probably will take another 2 to 3 months to kind of leg in. And unless the markets move, we will continue to put more money at what's hopefully the lower prices. The other and the last portion I want to mention, which did not change a lot, is the private investments. We are under policy targets, and that has a few reasons, but that's typical of kind of a market running up. So the denominator has been increasing, and distributions have been increasing from the private investments. So this is something that is below target, and will probably stay below target as distributions come in.
Bruce, real quick, the question on how we delayed the actual physical distribution, did you essentially take the quarterly distributions that you would have otherwise made and just put it into a cash account?
No, we tried to invest it like we would normally invest. It was a little more challenging because it's a shorter term phenomenon. But we didn't just put it in cash, because if we would have distributed it, that's where it would have sat.
Good.
And the whole point was to not distribute it, so right. We try to earn more money on it.
So we did get some uptick in return by delaying distribution.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't just in cash.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we sit, the senior investment team, led by Uzi, Susan, and Ryan, we all sit down every month and talk about sources and uses. And we look out kind of a quarter, two quarters, by month, and anticipate in consultation with the system when the needs mm-hmm. are going to be there, when we expect inflows. We do try to balance that. So, but to Bruce's point, I mean, philosophically, just feel like we got to continue to do business and not let a bunch of cash build up.
Right.
Because that's kind of suboptimal relative to the portfolio.
Absolutely. Well, and it's a real attribute to you guys, because I don't know if that'll occur again. You know, that was a unique set of circumstances, but be flexible, be nimble, and if we tell you to keep the money, but get a return on it,
right.
Not just put it into cash. So
yeah, and as you'll see, we have ample liquidity.
Right.
From that perspective.
Good.
So
well,
it's not
job well done on that. We're not just putting it in a, you know.
Well, again, I really do want to congratulate Uzi and Mark and Susan and, you know, the team. They do get together. You know, the biggest variables are what are the markets going to do? We don't know that. And then on the private equity, we don't know when we're going to get calls or when we're going to get distributions. So,
thank you.
But we look at it. We look at the cash count every day. And Uzi's done, I think, a great job over the last 6 months. Kind of, Kathy used to be the point person on this, and Uzi kind of took responsibility for it. Some of his colleagues got a little upset with him when he'd go around and want to move $1 million every week, and they told him they thought that was a little too sharp pencil. So I think it's working pretty well. And then, as we mentioned on the hedges, all we've really got going at this point is the Japanese yen, and you know, the cumulative value add is up to $4.4 billion. So that's a number we're awfully proud of. The next risk, because we don't invest directly, we invest with partners, is transparency risk. And since the least transparency is in the hedge fund book, I thought I'd ask Ryan to be on the line for this one.
Thanks for that. For the MCC portfolio across fixed income, real assets, and equities, I'll really just point you to
and
that.
We're on page 27 in the paper and 40 in Diligent.
Yep, thank you. Pointing to that 85% number for MCC, that is full portfolio transparency on a timely basis. That is primarily due to our managed accounts. The private equity portfolio is also full transparency, but on a quarter or two lagged basis. And
although in all fairness, that doesn't change that much. So, I mean, we have pretty good visibility in that, but
right.
It's not like it changes a whole lot that rapidly.
Right, and we do get it, for sure. And then for LCC, it is partial, however, it is substantial. You know, all of our managers, every month we get a portfolio exposure snapshot, you know, by sector, by geography, by asset class. We know what the leverage is. We know what the exposures are. We get attribution cut the same way. And then whether it's through that report or on the phone, you know, top 5, top 10, top 20 long positions, you know, names and sizes. And that usually represents 40, 50, 60% of the long portfolio. And really, it's the short portfolio that they keep proprietary due to borrow costs, competition, et cetera, that we don't get the full portfolio transparency. But they absolutely work with us on our diligence items.
Thank you. Mr. Warner, concentration risk.
Yep, so we're on page 29 of the paper copy, 42 in diligent. You all are used to seeing this. This is just the overall portfolio snapshot, the Uzi grid, the Bruce grid, as of the end of February. You know, what I would point out to you is just some of the bigger ticket items in the column on the far right. You know, we've got about 17% in credit and fixed income related investments. And so if you kind of think about the lower risk portion of the portfolio, even though the credit book is coming down over time strategically, think of that as kind of one of the asset class kind of shock absorbers. We have continued to grow the book in what is called in the institutional space. The real asset portfolio is up to about 20%. As you can see, half of that is in private investments in both real estate and natural resources. About 10% of it is in the MCC book, and three-quarters of that is in, a quarter of that is in gold, and then about half of that is in resource equities, and then another 2.5% is in commodity futures, and the rest is in the real estate MCC long-only book. What I would say then is going kind of down to the bottom, we're still about 64% equities overall. In the MCC book, that's about 60-40 developed country to emerging market. We've got about 30% of the LCC portfolio in sort of long-short equity strategies, which is the biggest part of their portfolio. And then we've gotten up to almost 30% in private equity. And as I think the board will recall, that is a long-term tactical strategic trajectory in the private equity book to continue to grow that portion of the portfolio over time.
And by the way, at the next Regents meeting, UT Regents meeting, May 13th or 14th, I think, we're going to focus in on the private investment part of our portfolio.
And what do? Kind of a detailed?
Yeah, a little more, because, you know, it's become a more important part of our book. It is arguably a riskier part of our book. And so Mark Warner and Mark Schoberg and Linda Leckman and I and Uzi are going to take our 16 minutes and go deeper. They gave us another minute, Steve. We asked, and they gave us another minute. We'll leave a minute for questions. And try to give the Regents, the client, a little more detailed view of our private investment book.
Yeah, and to Bruce's point, you know, risk, we have a whole dashboard of risks. It's liquidity risk that is what you're taking on more of in the private book, and it's also just a less understood asset class for folks that just don't do it every day. And so because it's a long-term strategic part of the portfolio that we're building, and because it's probably less understood, and because it represents a bit of a change in the portfolio liquidity, all of those things I think make it important just to, as you say, give some transparency and some
really
insight.
Good. I think when most people hear private investments, they think big buyouts. Well, that's not really what we're doing for the most part.
We have actually really low leverage all across the entire private equity portfolio on a relative basis to, say, buyouts, for example. Going to the next page, page 30 and 43, we're just slicing the portfolio in several different ways to give you some kind of insights overall into the diversification allocation of the overall portfolio. As you can see in the upper left, that's the total endowment by geography. And then we also compare that to the world's GDP and the global market cap of the various geographies, and so you can see that
public equity market.
Yes. You can kind of see how we compare to those, and on the bottom you can kind of see how the individual portfolios compare to global GDP and global market cap. And what I would tell you is if you look, I had Uzi pull me some information, just kind of looking back 5 and 10 years. 10 years ago, we were essentially a 60-40 equity bond portfolio, or equity fixed income portfolio. The book is much more diversified from a from an asset class perspective and a geography perspective. We're less North American centric than we were. I think a lot of that can be attributed to Susan and Amanda and their team pushing out on the edges in the MCC portfolio. We're much more global public equity investor than we were 10 years ago. And it's largely due to their great work. So as you think about the portfolio kind of strategically over time, it does look a lot different than 5 years ago and 10 years ago, and I think 5 years from now we'll continue on some of these marches that we've talked about. I think you'll see incrementally it being more global, a bit more emerging markets, and I think what you'll see is more private equity over time. Going to the country exposure, just the numbers, you can see how dramatic that is. You know, after the United States, the country drop-off, you know, a proxy, obviously in the public equity book column on the left, or the MCC book, equities and fixed income, but also just the total column, it still is a very United States-centric portfolio, despite those movements over the last 10 years. So this is not something that changes dramatically in the short term. You can see then the diversification across some of the other countries. And a lot of this, I would say, has to do with just the difficulty in investing in some of these markets. Some of these markets don't have real public equity markets. They're very thin after you get out of the developed countries. So that is an ongoing challenge just structurally. if you look at page 32, we show it by sector, where we are in the various portfolios. And again, I would say this is has become significantly more diversified. Going back 10 years ago, for example, we didn't have a real estate team, we didn't have a resources team. So those two teams have contributed to getting us more exposure in those sectors. And we see that kind of represented in the portfolio, and particularly I think where you see it is in the private investment portfolio, certainly versus 10 years ago, the efforts of those two sector-focused teams. So, you know, we talk a lot about concentration versus diversification. And I would say we're not fully done. Uzi's doing a ton of work in that area on how to kind of quantify the benefits and the drawbacks of being more diversified versus more concentrated. What I would tell you is I think we're more diversified from a geographic and a sector perspective. I think where we can maybe argue for concentration over time is in partners, is in getting bigger with the highest conviction partners, and so it may not translate into that much more diversification from a geography and a sector perspective. What it might do is it might put more hands and more high conviction managers where we're very important to them, and in turn they're very important to us. And so that kind of leads into the next page. What everybody did for their respective portfolios was calculate how much of the endowment portfolio, which is the x-axis, how much of the endowment portfolio is in each one of these partners' strategies versus how much of their AUM we are, which is the vertical axis. And what you can see is if you go to the very bottom right quadrant, really the bottom right eighth, where we have the biggest portions of the UTIMCO portfolio in a manager's hands, we are generally 10% or less of their total assets under management. And while that's not a small number, it gives you a sense that the folks that we have the biggest amount of our portfolio in their hands are big global asset managers for the most part. Conversely, if you look kind of to the far left, where we're a significant portion of, you know, 50, 60, 70% of a individual partner's portfolio, they tend to be smaller shops, and we were probably very significant investors with them as they started out. I think what you'll see over time is you'll see a bit of this migration into the upper right, where we don't have any representation right now, where we are both, we have a significant amount of our assets in their portfolio, and these folks, or excuse me, they are managing a big part of the endowment portfolio, and We are also a significant portion of their capital. I think you'll see some of these, because what I know factually is that, for example, a lot of the folks in the upper left are private equity partners where they haven't called that much of the capital we've actually committed to them. So I think as you see them call that capital, they're going to move to the right a bit. So, but it gives you, I think, at least this is only two axes, not Bruce's normal four, but it gives you a sense of not just how much of our money they're managing, but how much of their assets we represent. We think both of those are important as we think about concentration. If you go to the next slide, what you can see is just on an individual security basis, our single biggest exposure is the U.S. fixed income, U.S. government fixed income. I don't think that's any surprise. And the sovereigns represent a lot of our exposure. I don't know, Ryan, do you want to quickly, briefly talk about the Argentine position?
We're actually, we're running way behind.
Okay. So as you could see, from an individual security standpoint, other than the sovereign debt, there's no big single contributors.
And then on illiquidity?
On illiquidity, we remain in the zones. You can see our unfunded commitments, as we talked about the private equity book, creeping up over time. But it is creeping up. It's not spiking up.
All right. Russ and Ryan will quickly go through leverage for us. We don't have much, so
absolutely,
we don't have to belabor it.
Yeah. As far as the page 51 diligent and page 38 paper, non-insurance related to internal derivatives, we don't have much change since the last quarter. I would point out that as far as the biggest activity, you see that in the gold futures where they reduced out of the allocation between gold bars and futures. As far as the biggest net notional, that's Japan forwards, which are hedging out currency exposure to the yen. We go on to the next page, external manager agency account derivatives. We didn't have any additional strategies this quarter over last quarter, so that's fairly vanilla as well. And then finally, on page 53 and page 40, over-the-counter derivative counterparty report. You can see here we have really a very low net exposure to any counterparty.
Russ usually goes on and on and on, so thank you for being terse. Oh, okay. You'll have your chance.
On page 54 in Diligent, you'll see the line graphs. Really the way to think about the look-through leverage of the hedge fund portfolios for every dollar. It's about $1.16 long and 81 cents short. So it's a meaningful short book, a little bit of long leverage. You add those up, you get $2 of investments, but only 35% net exposure. And the reason for the adjustments in the two lines is with and without the highly levered macro strategies of fixed income and currency. Those are non-recourse, and so we quote it both ways, and it's a little bit of capital, but substantial.
That's mostly Bridgewater, and we spent a lot of time
talking
with Kyle's help.
Bruce, is your gold in the physical, or is it
both physical and
primarily in physical?
So bars, you got?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll skip over permanent loss because we're going to dive a little deeper into that, and let me go through the portfolio reviews. I'll just mention that since the last board meeting, we've had our semi-annual reviews. Terry joins us for a lot of those. It's where we spend a few hours, 2-3 hours, going into each portfolio in more depth. I really look forward to them. I'm sure my colleagues look forward to them as well. So, Russ, you want to, or Harlan, whoever's going to do fixed income?
So now, page 58, Diligent, page 45, and paper for our IGFI book. I'd like to point out our value add across fiscal year, 1 year, 3 years, 5 years. We're happy with those numbers. The thing that makes us most proud, though, is the portfolio information ratio. We'd like to, we aim actually try to get something around 0.5 to 0.75 when we target for our managers. The book's been very successful to be above that. We're very happy about that. And then finally, you can see on the right the mix of the managers, 30% of the internal book,
24% with Brandywine, 18% with PIMCO, who are global managers, and then 17% with Colchester, and 11% with FIA, who are global ex-US managers. Moving on to the next page, our portfolio duration, if you look in the overview on the upper left-hand corner, the portfolio is slightly shorter in duration than our benchmark overall, yet yielding 90 basis points more than the benchmark. Our average agency rating is slightly below the benchmark, only one gradation. Moving on to the upper right corner, geographic exposure. Our biggest differences are Europe, 8.7% underweight, and that's primarily to core Europe. We have a 2.7% underweight to Asia Pacific, but that does mask a 10% underweight to Japan versus the benchmark. And in emerging markets, we have a 11.3% overweight.
And Mexico's a
Mexico
is a portion of that.
Piece of that. Around, I'll give you the exact figure. It was 6%.
Did we buy some of that 100-year bond they issued?
Well, I know I didn't, but I don't think I remember seeing that come up in the purchases.
Will you remind the board as to what level, what yield level that came at? Mexico issued a 100-year bond.
In euros, right?
In euros. No, tell me, what rate did it come at, Russ?
These guys don't trade that.
4%
in the fourth.
Yeah, 4.2, I think it was.
I'm sure that'll be a great 100-year piece of paper.
100 years.
That'll never trade below par, right?
Since you can count on your two hands the yield on a German Bund in basis points in at 10 years. So, anyway, that's where Mexico is in euros. As far as currency exposure goes, in the lower left-hand corner, you've got euro currency exposure is a large underweight, 14.6%. Emerging, we have a large overweight at 12%. Mexico, once again, is the biggest piece of that at 4.5%. South Africa, Malaysia, Chile, Brazil, India are all between 1% and 2% overweights. And then finally, in the Japanese yen, we're 6.8% underweight, which has been coming down lately over the last few quarters and during this quarter as well. So we'll see how that evolves. Finally, looking in the lower right-hand corner, the big underweight in the portfolio, and this has been consistent over several quarters, is the 12.8% underweight to securitized. The Fed being involved with the agency mortgage market in the U.S. is distorting that market, making it extremely rich, is a big driver of that underweight. And then finally, we're overweight 17.2% in treasuries and sovereigns. Unless there are any questions.
And you promised that 4.5% value add just on an ongoing basis, right? That's the new normal?
Where were we when I promised that?
You've been a great job. Thank you. Mark Warner on resources, the long only book.
Yeah, so quickly on commodities, just picking up where we left off the last time we talked, again, a historic drawdown for our portfolio in the fourth quarter of calendar 13, the first fiscal quarter, basically. Both our commodity and our equity book had significant drawdowns. Again, we run a higher beta, much more discretionary portfolio in both those, the commodity and the equity portfolios. In commodities, we were long energy. When energy corrected, we were long, but we were out on the curve. So contract selection helped, but the fact that we were overweight energy was a significant detractor. They were buying what they thought, what they felt at the time, kind of in June, July of last year, buying December 14 oil at sort of $85 or $80 looked really cheap relative to where the front end of the curve was. So we've continued to kind of claw back since our drawdown through April. And again, you don't have these numbers. These are through February on the sheet. Through April, we're now on a fiscal year basis only down about 200 basis points, where at our peak we were down probably 600 or 700 basis points in the commodity portfolio. Likewise, in the equity portfolio, if you flip the page, the fiscal year-to-date numbers through the half of April were down about 5%, where we were down double digits at the peak, kind of in November, December last year. What's happened is our managers have continued to reposition the portfolios. The markets have come back a little bit. I think most of you that watch it know oil's up a bit over the last 2 weeks. That has really helped. Our portfolios, particularly in commodities, the position hasn't changed that much. The challenge in commodities is that there's a significant negative roll yield. That is, everything's in contango. Almost all the curves are going up and to the right. It's very, very hard to perform on an absolute basis in that term structure. And then the currency headwinds across both equities and commodities have been significant. But what we've done, back to kind of Uzi's point, is rather than backing up the truck in 1 month and saying, let's get to equal weight, we have been adding about $30 million a month into both the equity and the portfolio and the commodity portfolio. And just to give you a sense, those additions have significantly outperformed the benchmark. The equities, for example, have outperformed 12.2% versus the bench at 2.5%. So we've made almost 10% outperformance just in about $100 million of additions that we put in the book. And what we told our partners was, put them in the highest beta, high conviction names you have. Because what we're trying to do is position the portfolio for that correction back in the market, which none of us is sure when it'll come. That's why we're not taking a view on timing. We're just trying to sort of average our way back into being equal weight. And we're going to talk internally about whether we should go overweight, because when you look at an asset class perspective, this is the most sort of oversold asset class. And so as we rebalance the portfolio, there's a chance we could even go overweight here.
Thank you. Mark Schoberg is with one of our partners at their annual meeting. He left Edward Lewis behind, Eddie, to tell us about the real estate book.
Great.
Long-only book.
The long-only book. If you'll turn to page 62 in the diligent, 49 in the paper copy. We'll start with the pie chart on the upper right. Our REIT book was valued at $870 million at the end of February of this year. That's up from $837 at the end of calendar year 2014. Today, that represents roughly 2.7% of the endowments and 3.2% of the ETF. Breaking down the pie chart just a little bit, we have four managers, and those four managers represent five different mandates that we have in our REIT book. Shifting over to the top left chart, the first two lines focus on our performance and the benchmark performance. I'd say on the 1, 3, and 5 year basis, REITs have done well, posting double digit returns across the board. So absolute returns into the endowments have been strong. On the value add, on the third line is where our portfolio has lost value against the benchmark. And really that's been for a couple of reasons that we've talked to our manager. The first being, we've seen significant capital inflows into the REIT space as investors have looked for yield alternatives. Our managers tend to underperform in those environments. They tend to focus on what they consider higher quality REIT names with higher quality portfolio exposure, and investors have been willing to take a lower quality portfolio risk in REIT names in exchange for higher yields. We've underperformed by regional allocation, where we've made some regional allocations to Asia and Latin America that just haven't worked out. We've been a little bit early. And one of our managers has some organizational challenges. If we move down to sort of the bottom left, which is our capital.
Well, to be clear, so a manager left an existing organization, joined a new organization that we have a long-standing relationship with. So we think that manager is on the upside of the organizational challenges they've had. The old organization wanted them to grow assets. The new organization does not. This manager doesn't want to, and the manager wants to manage less money and therefore be able to invest in more, smaller cap names.
And these are 100% public equities?
Yes.
Okay.
Public.
Yes, so this is 100% public real estate book. The bottom left just talks about what we've done to try to rectify our problem with our performance. So we've turned our book over 50%. We've added three new mandates to our book to attempt to recover some of the underperformance that we've seen.
Thank you. Susan, the public equities.
The chart on the left for the 6 months ended February, the portfolio outperformed the benchmark by 690 basis points. So
That's good, isn't it, Keith?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're pleased that active management continues to be strong. In particular, we benefited from strong performance by one U.S. manager, two of our global managers, our Europe manager and Japan manager. Portfolio volatility continues to be consistent or roughly on par with market volatility. And in terms of portfolio composition, the pie chart on the right, we continue to have 12 managers. Fiscal year to date, we have not added capital to this part of the endowment. We did make some redemptions from a U.S. manager, a global manager, and our Japanese manager in order to do and develop back to closer to equal weight.
And one of the things I've done, you know, with Kathy's departure, much to Susan and Amanda, and you'll see in a minute Ryan and Corbin's chagrin, is I've met with a lot of our managers just to kind of reinforce the continuity, UTIMCO continuity. They're clearly Susan and Amanda and Ryan and Courtney's relationships. So I don't think I've ruined too many of them. It's a close call on some of them. But for example, since August, I've met with 9 out of 12 of these managers. And on the next page, there's in the emerging markets, there's 19 managers. I've met with 5 of them. I haven't traveled internationally, particularly since the beginning of the calendar year, because when the legislature is in session, I feel like I need to be on call. So I'm looking forward to visiting more of these EM managers beginning in the summer.
So here you see the box on the left. We've been in a tough period for EM with both local equity markets and EM currencies down relative to the U.S. dollar. The portfolio has outperformed the benchmark in the 6th of February. We benefited from strong performance by 3 of our GEM managers, as well as good active management from one of our Brazilian managers and 2 of our Asian managers. We also benefited, as Bruce mentioned, from our overweight to China, even though our China manager underperformed its benchmark. The China market was up 12 to water. In terms of portfolio composition, 19 managers, fiscal year date, we have added some capital, all to existing managers. You see in the box on the bottom left, and the source of funding there was primarily GEM managers.
Which is global emerging markets, is what GEM stands for. By the way, I forgot to mention my main takeaway from my tour of Susan, Amanda, and Ryan and Courtney's managers are they have great books, great managers, and they have great relationships with those managers. So again, if I can avoid messing them up, we should continue to do well. I always mention that my colleagues are worried when I go visit a manager because they think some combination of 3 things could happen. I'll mess up a good relationship. If I'm meeting with a prospect, I'll front run the team, or I'll just plain embarrass them. And I think I did all 3 in one meeting once.
Call that the trifecta.
Yes.
So far, so good. So for the hedge fund portfolio, $11.3 billion in total. As a reminder, 30% allocation for the endowments, 45% for ITF. It's roughly $3 billion to the ITF and closer to $8 billion for the endowments. We focus an equity-like return profile. This is not a pension, fixed income kind of return profile. Just want to make that clear. So instead of 3, 4, 5% targets, we're shooting for 7, 8%. As far as returns in the last 6 months, we're up 3.8%. This is an environment with equities globally up 1% and high yield credit down 1%. So we feel good about the absolute return. On a relative basis, we're outperforming in the last 6 months by 130 basis points. This is less in the last 6 and 12 months than historically. And part of that compression is we looked at what the fund of funds are invested in versus us, and we're overweight event and credit, which have struggled, and we're underweight CTAs and systematic strategies that have done pretty well in this QE environment. And so that's the biggest explanatory factor for the compression in performance. On the right, the pie chart, no major changes in the strategy allocation on the margin. Long short equity has gone up 1% or 2%, and credit and event have been diluted a little bit. This represents 70 funds, but there's about a dozen liquidating side pockets and about a dozen where we're in multiple funds with the same relationship. So it's really 46 relationships is how we think about it. And you see the concentration by relationship. The top 10 are 46%. Historically, this has been closer to 50. And the top 20 relationships are 72% versus 75 to 80.
So and I've only got to 28 of your 46, so I have 18 more to go to wreak havoc in your book.
Let's do it. And, you know, the liquidity, the leverage we've talked about, and you can see the capital activity, four new mandates, and the rest are existing.
So next page is the private investment portfolio, page 53 paper, 66 diligent. On the bottom left, you'd see where we began the fiscal year at $7.2 billion, and we're up to $7.4 billion of net asset value, remains 28% of the book. However, our unfunded commitments have grown from 4.8 up to 5.9, so from 19% up to 22%. Looking at the new commitments, we've made 27 commitments totaling $1.9 billion. This is consistent with the long-term models we have as to how much we'll commit. Our target for the full year is $2.5 billion roughly, so we've really kind of front-loaded a lot of the commitments. We've got some coming, but we project that we'll be on our target of about $2.5 billion for the full year. The portfolio's been self-funding. The calls of $803 million have roughly offset the distributions, or the distributions are slightly higher than the calls. Overall, the book's up 3.3%. The real estate portfolio's up 6%. The natural resources has gotten marked down, but only by 1.7% through February. I don't think we have all the full year returns in yet. The venture is a bright spot, up 16%. By the way, you may have read last week there was a big IPO of Etsy. Union Square, of which we're the largest LP, was a large investor in Etsy. And so Lindell, who is also at a partner's annual meeting, we have put in roughly about $3 million into Etsy, and at the current value it's worth about $60 million. Even though it was IPO, that hadn't been realized yet, but just an example of when venture works, it's a beautiful thing. On the next page is our update on our co-investments. For the fiscal year, we've made 7 co-investments. We looked at 42. I'm on the far right. We made 7, $184 million. Since inception, we've made 43 private investment commitments, almost $900 million of capital committed, about $20 million per private. It's still very, very early in the life of this program. We've had, I think, 2 full or mostly full monetizations, both in our natural resources book. And so that one's showing a great multiple and IRR. And the other books are supposed to be marked to market. And so, they continue to make progress. The only other thing I'd mention on the ITF is that it remains very liquid. And in the contracts update, we did bring in a coach for our technology team, which is has a tremendous project that Uche will give you an update on, and I think they're making good, strong progress. It's just tough sledding. So that's the funds update. I know we're about 17 minutes behind schedule. I think we can make up some of that time. At the very least, we'll just shorten your lunch. But let me roll into permanent loss of capital, if I may, which is our 10th risk. The way I frame this is, in the investment management community, there's somewhat of, I would almost call it a religious war as to what's the definition of risk. Is it volatility or is it loss of capital? And in true UTIMCO fashion, we don't choose less filling or taste great. We want both. So we are very focused on volatility and downside scenarios, but we also want to look at our permanent loss of capital. Of course, I've never met an investor that makes an investment saying, I'm going to lose my capital, but I'm going to do it anyway. So I don't think anyone ever plans on or expects a permanent loss of capital, but it happens. And so on page 2 behind tab 4, page 74 in Diligent, just to kind of set a bit of a framework, you know, banks make loans and they lose money on those loans, anywhere from 50 basis points to 1% a year. The leverage loan market has losses. The high yield market, debt market has losses. Public equities are a little harder to estimate what a permanent loss of capital is. Private investments around 4%. In venture capital, what this 33% represents is that one out of three venture investments loses all its money. So even though no one plans on a permanent loss of capital, it happens. So what we did, in the spirit of transparency and seeing what we could learn, we looked back at our 19-year history, where we've made almost $60 billion of investments, decisions, $59.9 billion of investment decisions. The number's not on this page, but those are 700, that represents 730 individual investment decisions. We have realized $1.2 billion of losses, and when we look at our book, we anticipate another $300 million of losses. So we've lost $1.5 billion, either have or anticipate losing $1.5 billion on that $60 billion of investment decisions. That is 2.5%. But by the way, that's not 2.5% a year. That's 2.5% over 19 years. Now, some of the investment decisions we've made over the last few years where we don't anticipate losing money, we're going to lose some money. But to date, that 2.5% over 19 years works out to a little less than 15 basis points a year. So we're pretty proud of no one likes to lose money. We don't like losing money, but we think we've done a reasonably good job of being conservative with these assets, given our return hurdles. And by the way, all the return numbers you've seen are after these losses, as well as any more temporary mark-to-market losses.
So, Bruce, just for clarification, those would be realized losses.
So the 1.192 is realized.
And that
can happen in a private portfolio where it's monetized, it's done. Where you see some of the anticipated is a private portfolio, a private fund, it's not done, but it's winding down and we really don't think we're going to make our money back. In the hedge fund portfolio, it'll be we've invested with the manager and we've redeemed.
Okay.
Now, in the long only, we invested and we redeemed, but what you'll see on the next page is we tried to parse how much of that was due to market and how much of that was due to the manager. So, Susan, if you want to pick up on kind of the analysis we did on the long-only book.
So this is just for clarification. This isn't just instances of a complete loss of capital. It's just you don't get all that you
correct.
Invested.
Any loss. Correct. Any loss, anything under than getting back 100 cents on the dollar.
So page 3 in the paper copy, page 75 of Diligent, out of the 149 MCC managers we've invested with, $34 billion of capital deployed, we found 27 MCC investments where there have been absolute losses generated at the time of manager termination. So these managers amounted to invested capital of about $4.2 billion, generating total absolute losses of about $600 million. So of the $600 million of losses, we estimate that about two-thirds or $400 million is attributable to market movements, and a third or $200 million is attributable to active management decisions. Reason we break it out like this, as opposed to private investments or LCC, is that MCC investments are liquid. So as we terminate and the market's down and the manager may be up relative to the market or down relative to the market. So we wanted to differentiate what was active management versus market losses. So
and typically, we'll take the redeemed assets and reinvest them in the same market,
right,
either passively or with a different manager in that market.
So in most cases, the reason for termination was manager upgrading, particularly in the 08-09 period. You can see 08-09 source of funds as a row there. There were a number of managers that had not previously been open that opened up to new capital at that time, and we took that opportunity to upgrade the portfolio. We did have a few cases where managers were terminated because of concern about ongoing business viability, one in emerging markets and one in developed countries. So kind of the lessons we take away from looking at this data is, you know, one, because we had the luxury of liquidity in this portfolio, it's not necessarily a bad thing to crystallize a loss and, you know, redeploy that capital elsewhere, either the better MCC manager or elsewhere in the endowment. And then two, just manager burnout or disengagement or business viability is something that we should continue to watch for.
Susan, can I ask a question? One of the things we know from the recent trend in behavioral finance is people tend to hold on to losing positions longer and get out of winners. So I guess the question is, we haven't reported this. You may have been aware of all of this internally, but the board's only seeing this over the last couple of meetings. I think it's a great addition. But now that it's a very public thing or a very visible thing, do you think that'll change your self-discipline at all with regard to when you get in or out of managers, particularly when you liquidate a position?
Yeah, I think it's something that, you know, we always try to be conscious of. You know, we do kind of recognize there's an inherent human bias, like, oh, that's not working out, let's wait around and see if it works out. But, you know, there's also, you know, lots of MCC managers out there that are great. And so and some of them that we have on a watch list are closed. So when they open up and we have the opportunity to upgrade, I don't think we'll say, well, let's stick with this position that hasn't worked yet if there's an obviously better.
It's a really good question.
But to do that, it would actually count against the statistics right now.
Yeah,
okay.
It would, yeah.
I'm curious what the line item star manager bad behavior means.
Oh, that's my next.
That's
so go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I went one page too far. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, there is some code involved.
Really?
You represent the star manager or the bad behavior?
Neither. On the 7 years and 9 years that Courtney and I have been here respectively, we've experienced most of these losses, so we thought we'd be a united front and walking you through them. Actually, of these 17 losses, 4 of those managers were hired before I joined in November of 2005. A dozen were hired in 2006, 2007, and 2008, and only one has been hired post the financial crisis for a $1 million loss. So we think we're learning and getting better over time, but by no means perfect. And another important data point is none of these managers were sized at greater than a 2.5% weighting within our portfolio. So these were all satellite positions. They were not core. We sized them based on the risk reward, but as you'll see in several instances, the losses exceeded the managers and our expectations. So a lot of numbers, but if you take the 104 investments and $12.6 billion, $1.2 billion of that $12.6 has experienced a loss. So that is a cumulative default rate of 10% is one way to think about it. And of that $1.2 billion, what was the amount of the loss? It was $437 million. So that's like a 35% loss severity when a loss occurs. Now, a little over half of those losses have been realized, and a little less than half are still anticipated. And as I think about that loss severity, it really comes down to two cohorts. The high severity cohort, which is the first three categories that I'll walk through, that blend to a 64% severity. Obviously, these are the worst outcomes. And then the less severe cohort that Courtney will walk through. And what's interesting is it's almost the 80-20 rule. 76% of the losses are explained by only 30% of the managers, these first three buckets that I'll discuss. And 26% of the losses are explained by 70% of the managers. So the first line item, the concentration illiquidity, it's really the combination of both that was the lesson learned and the problem. So both managers drew down in the crisis. Both managers tried to come back but did not make back high water marks. They were quite a ways away. One manager decided to unwind the business. It was just uneconomic. It was $100 million of assets. The math didn't make sense. And his mandate was always a small cap, concentrated portfolio. And when he went to liquidate, you know, half of the portfolio came back quickly, and the other half has been, you know, trading by appointment, getting out when he can. And it's the combination of being wrong and stuck that has led to more severe losses. The other manager is in Hong Kong, you know, had $1 billion in the fund at one point, a more aggressive portfolio manager, diagnosed with cancer in 2011, and again, about half of the capital came back pretty quickly, and the other half between some Malaysian conglomerates, some Hong Kong property, has been a severe outcome. The next line item, use of leverage, is our only complete loss of capital. This was Park Central in Dallas in 2008. We went through it in detail at the time. Basically, even though they were experienced portfolio managers, even though they were part of the Perot family office, bottom line, they used 15, 20, at the peak, 24 times gross leverage in fixed income arbitrage. So going into the crisis, they couldn't meet margin calls. Nothing could be done. So that was a $115 million loss. What comes to mind when thinking about the lesson learned of avoid high leverage is Bridgewater and Bain and other macro managers. As we compare and contrast the two, their leverage is in the 6, 8, 10, maybe 12 times at the peak versus 20 or 24 times. And they are diversified across asset classes and in liquid level one derivatives as opposed to purely fixed income arbitrage in custom derivative contracts. So that's how we think about that. And then star manager bad behavior is a longtime top performing manager who in the financial crisis decided to change significant legal items in the documents in a way that we didn't agree with. We didn't think they were acting in accordance with their fiduciary duty. It was a material adverse change. Clearly, we didn't consent. We were asked to leave the fund. We knew we were selling that portfolio low at 50 cents on the dollar. However, we were able to find not only better fiduciary partners, but buy distressed credit with the proceeds. And since that time, we've heard and seen things in the press that just continue to surprise us, and that leads to people that you think are good can ultimately change.
So the next category, in the recession, to rebalance the endowment, we redeemed from 7 lower conviction managers to redeploy into higher conviction opportunities. It was $437 million and crystallized, call it $56 million in losses. We really felt that for the dollar forward at that point, there were better options to trade up and concentrate the book. The first 4 categories you just talked about were more crisis-related. The next 2 are idiosyncratic or directly manager-related. Style drift, 3 managers started acting in a way that we didn't expect or outside their mandate, and the decision was made to move on, redeem, and then...
And when you say outside their mandate, within their guidelines, but it just wasn't what they had advertised and therefore underwrote to and expected.
Someone who is typically a long short equity manager decided to go very bearish and very net short or swing around their exposures to take tactical bets. It's just not how we underwrote to the manager, and we felt it was best to move on. New manager, material underperformance. This is just a function of investing with somebody who's less well known or less proven that we thought would be a strong performer. Didn't work out for various reasons, both performance related or operationally related, and the decision was to kind of cut bait and move on and put that money elsewhere.
Like Susan said, it's a high bar. We're always force curving the portfolio, and if they're not delivering what we expect, then we're going to hold them accountable.
And Lindell is at a manager meeting, so ask Scott to do the cleanup here on permanent loss of capital. I don't want to put any pressure on you, but you're what's standing between us and lunch.
So with privacy fees, a similar methodology with a few tweaks to kind of account for what differences in privacy. The headline number is $451 million of expected losses on about $13.4 billion of capital in private investment. That equates to about a 3.4% projected loss rate. When you dig into that further, the 451, about 75% of that, or $327 million, is fully realized. So we've either sold these assets in the secondary market or the funds have realized. Of the 327, $210 million of those were actually, or two-thirds of that, was from secondary sales. And I'll talk about that in the next slide a little bit. On the anticipated losses, we kind of went fund by fund for everything that's still active and said, what do we expect for future losses? Had to make some assumptions there, it'll change over time, and that was our current views, another 124 of losses from active ones. And as you look at the different asset classes here, it's really the old portfolios that have been around long enough to experience losses. So you'll see developed country equity, venture, and credit is about 85% of the 451 losses. So looking at the next slide, we dug into these older portfolios to see if there were any lessons learned or takeaways from our history here. And these portfolios go all the way back to the 80s, so we've got some good data to look at. We cut these losses both by type, so we bucketed it into kind of private equity buyouts, venture capital, and credit and other investments. A couple things to note, I mentioned about half of these losses, the 451, were from secondary sales. We made an active decision to sell in exposure. And some of those decisions were not so much that we thought they were going to lose money ultimately, but just we had a better use of capital. What we did is we tracked these sales post us selling them. We looked at other investors' reports and said, look, about half of those secondary sales, the guys actually made money on the fund. We just felt like we had a better opportunity to redeploy at that time. So that's one takeaway. You know, I think another thing is vintage matters. That's a lesson learned for us. As you see the losses here, the big spikes came kind of in the late 90s around the technology bubble and also in the mid-2000s around the kind of pre-financial crisis and some of the large LBOs. So I think we, given where we are in the market today, we're very conscious of that. We want to be make sure we stick to our budgets, make sure we don't stretch, and we're killing a lot of deals today because of that. So we're trying to stay conservative. A few other takeaways.
And that's why we really do, and we haven't kind of taken the board through it, but we put a fair amount of effort into modeling what our private investment commitments should be. Because, again, it's a very long-lived asset class. It's hard to call the cycles. And so, but we do a lot of projections to come up with with what we think our annual commitment should be on a steady state. And then given the cycles, we may pull back or step on the gas a little bit if we have some strong view about where we are. Right now, you know, we certainly don't want to overshoot our commitment targets.
So we definitely have some lessons learned here. We hate losing money in any strategy that we're doing. A few things that we looked at this data and felt a little bit of comfort around is just the, you know, the 3%, 3.5% loss rate on our highest risk asset class felt reasonable to us. Again, we hate losing money, but that felt reasonable. And also, I think when you think about private equity, you know, a takeaway for us is that, you know, it is common to lose money on individual private equity deals. You hear about them in the papers, you know, small deals you hear about losing money. But on a fund level basis with a diversified portfolio, it is rare to lose money on a total fund basis. So, and that's really what we do. We're really fund investors. And then even when you do lose money, I think Ryan mentioned it on their book, when you do lose money, we capture everything lost a dollar. So it's not always a zero that comes out of that. So I think on average, when we've lost any money at all, we've actually covered about 63 cents on the dollar, so about 37% capital loss on the deals that have lost money. So don't think of when we do lose money, that's a complete wipeout.
Bruce, it looks like both on LCC and privates, about 15% of your managers, just irrespective of funds under management, of course, about 15% of them fall out. I mean, what do you think about that? For every 100, 15 are going to go away over time. Does that feel
sounds,
right?
Yeah, that actually sounds about right. Feels about right. You know, we'd obviously love for it to
You're
be
trying
zero.
To minimize that.
Right, but you know, we're not going to get it right all the time. And as, you know, on the secondary sales, and then as Ryan and Susan mentioned, sometimes we're upgrading. Sometimes it's not that they've necessarily been so horrible. Maybe it's been a bad market, but we're just, you know, it's trite to say, but we want to re-underwrite our book every day.
I think our number would actually be higher because of that, because we've really shifted, like for big buyouts, for instance. We had a lot of managers there pre-crisis, and we've really shifted totally away from that. So even if we haven't sold them in the secondary market, we don't think we're going to go forward with those guys. So those numbers will come up over time. But even when we don't miss, we might not re-up with guys. So.
And you know, part of what we are trying to do strategically is, we call it sponsoring partnerships, where we're coming in earlier, we're coming in large. They're not all going to work out.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes managers get too big or raise fees or change stripes, and you like them, but you have to move on.
It seems like every day in the newspaper, you know, you see big fund going out of business. Of course, you don't know what's coming in. They don't really report that in the newspaper, but it seems like lots of hedge funds are closing up shop and moving on. So,
if we want to, we ran over, but I think we can make up the time. But if we wanted to break for lunch.
Yeah, let's break for lunch, and then you can do your organizational update post-lunch, and then we'll go into committees. How's that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And we're going to be